Welcome back, everybody. We decided the world didn't have enough podcasts, so we're making a second one. Unlike the last one about the Caravelle, this one is about history's most consequential aircraft and the engineering behind them, more specifically their technological and societal impacts. We started off at 1903 and brought it over to present day, and we're going to go through eight planes with you. But first, we have to introduce today's useful idiot. So we don't have Eric or Hayden like last time because they weren't stupid enough. So we found Will Johnson.
I'll top them all. I'm probably as dumb as they come. And for those of you listening, I'm sure you hear the what's left of the accent and you're like, yeah, that sounds about right. This kid's probably the dumbest we've had on the show. But one thing I'll start with is that, you know, Dave, there's probably enough podcasts.
We already said that, but we're making a second one. You can't tell if he's from Georgia. And that's pretty much where I'm going to leave that one. So the eight planes we're going to go through to kind of walk you through the history of the airplane, just how it's developed over time and the impact it's had, is we're going to start off with the Wright Flyer, which I think everybody knows of.
Of course.
The Junkers J-1, which almost nobody knows
of.
Yeah,
that one's going to be an interesting one to go through for sure. Right.
We'll talk a little bit about that. The Spirit of St. Louis, ME-262, Bell X-1, North American X-15, Lockheed F-117A, and then lastly, we'll wrap it up with the F-16, and that'll kind of bring us into the modern age. It was really hard to pick eight aircraft, and unfortunately, they were all American or German, so the scope was very small for exactly where these planes were built for this project, but if you'll get the effect they had and you map it over the entire globe, almost the entire globe is lit up, minus a couple parts of Africa and in the stands in that kind of region. But we'll just kick right into it with the Wright Flyer. That one was in 1903, and for the technological impacts it had, the first thing was that the Wright brothers were actually one of the first people we've ever known to use flight test. So you also had, I believe it was Curtis LeMay or there was an engine company. Who's the engine company?
Not sure. LeMay. I'm the idiot here.
Langley. It was Pierpont Langley. That's what it was. He was the guy that Wright was competing against to build the first plane. And the government was just pumping money into Pierpont Langley because he was like the smartest dude ever. And then you had the Wright brothers who owned a bicycle shop. But what they did that Pierpont didn't was they did a lot of flight test and wind tunnel testing. They did have wind tunnels back then. There were still studies about fluids and planes and that kind of stuff. So nobody had built one of those planes. But they actually started using flight tests with that. They'd push a plane, it would crash horribly, and they would try again and again and again. And they test all their ideas for how does a wing fly, how does a propeller work, all this stuff in a little wind tunnel they had back in their shop.
Oh, wow.
So that was something new that they had.
So I guess my first question is, like, how do you even power those wind tunnels with the technology they had then? I mean, that just seems like something that you wouldn't really think of or that I guess wouldn't really come intuitively when you think of a wind tunnel now.
Honestly, you just really stick a fan in front of a tube and you make the tube get a little smaller.
Really?
It wasn't the most advanced. They just needed something to see if it would produce an upward force. So like if they put an airfoil in there, they could measure the force the wind produced up on it.
Yeah.
Some kind of CR, something like that, and it would work. The other thing they did is they made a bunch of leaps forward just how you think about a plane. So one of them was they figured out how a wing flew, but nobody really knew how propellers worked. But they realized, well, a propeller is really just a spinning wing placed forward. Yeah. This is lift backwards, which means the plane goes forward because of Newton's forces. So that was one of the first things they did. They also realized the plane has three axes on it.
Okay.
So that was just, it can roll, which is its wings going left and right. Yep. It can yaw, nose going left and right. It can pitch, nose going up and down.
So why are those three axes important? What was so revolutionary about thinking of flight that way?
It's not even that's real. I mean, it makes total sense because we live in a 3D world, so things can usually only move in three directions. I guess you could technically say there's thrust in there somehow, but the way the motion of the plane works. So what they realized from that was if you have three ways the plane can go up, down, left, right, bank, all that kind of stuff, then you need a control surface to control each of those three axes. So before they used to not realize, oh, we probably need to make the nose yaw left and right, so let's use a rudder. They would just put some wings on it and go really fast and hope it flew. So that's why they were part of the first controlled manned flight, not just flight. Then the other thing they did is they realized the aircraft is a whole system. So a lot of people look at it as like, oh, okay, here's the engine. Let's just build an engine, put it on. Here's the structure. Here's the aerodynamics. Here's flight controls, all this kind of stuff. They thought of it separately. But the Wright brothers were one of the first people to actually realize that this plane is a whole integrated system. Those don't exist independently. The weight of the engine affects how the aerodynamics go, which affects how the controls go, which affects, again, how the engine goes, and so on and so forth. And they realized the interconnectedness of all this stuff. So that was all the technological stuff. At the point, it was pretty cool.
Wow. It's interesting too, because from my understanding, the Wright brothers just found a plane in the woods, and that was when flight was invented. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's interesting that there were so many technological advances an aeronautical theory that, you know, existed as far back as 1903.
What was cool about it is they didn't even know half the crap they were doing. It was really just they tested the living crap out of it, and they developed all their own stuff, because there's no NACA charts to go show you lift curve profiles of an airfoil or anything like that. They just tested different designs. And
What's a NACA chart for those like myself who don't know what that is?
When America realized it was really far behind in aviation, NACA is a National Aviation Advisory, Advisory Committee for Aviation. That's what it was.
Gotcha.
And they were just a body put together to help America get good at airplanes, basically.
And what,
just a bit.
What important information can you get from those charts that they didn't have available back then?
Oh, just every airfoil based on the shape is going to stall it. Different angles of attack, which is just the angle between the cord and the wind, and it increases lift a certain proportion for each increase of degree and angle of attack. And you would look and get that kind of information from there, and based on different Reynolds numbers, it would change and stuff like that.
Interesting. So there, I guess that's going to help you pick an airfoil based off of what your expected flight profile is going to be, things like that.
It just tells you different things about the way different airfoils act.
Gotcha.
Really, they were just trying to figure out what flew. NACA knew what flew. They just had to see how did different things fly. But the Wright Flyer also had some societal impacts, and this is really the big thing it did. So obviously, there's a lot of technological achievement there. You can find a whole book on it. It's actually really freaking cool if you find some time to go get it. But first and foremost, it launched the aerial age. Obviously, now planes are here. They're flying. Immediately, the military is like, oh, I want to use those.
Yeah.
So then you start to have that happen, and you can get into it. We could do a whole another podcast, which we won't, because the world has enough podcasts for this one. But you could do a whole other podcast on just how aviation developed with the first World War I, how dogfighting went. That's awesome stuff. But it launched that age. And then it kind of started to get, it didn't break into popular culture, but it became a very popular thing. So Picasso and Kafka started having paintings with the planes in it. You would look on clocks, they'd incorporate it in there. They'd incorporate it into watches. They started putting planes on cigarette boxes. Basically, it just kind of became like the, I don't want to say like a Tesla, but kind of like because nobody puts Teslas in paintings. He's not that I know of.
Yeah.
And if they did, I probably wouldn't buy it.
Probably modern art these days, honestly.
No, that's just a white canvas.
That's
somehow somebody figured out how to get $1 million for. I'm stuck over here just mad because I didn't think of it myself.
Honestly, those are the real geniuses.
But most importantly, the world just got excited for aviation. And that kind of ties back into the aerial age.
So how quickly did it take from the Wright Flyers performing their first flight to the rest of the world kind of finding out about this new heavier-than-air aircraft?
I have no idea. But I imagine not very long at all. They probably published it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I know the biggest thing is after they did announce it, though, Pierpont Langley just went up and quit. It's like, I don't want to do this anymore. Screw it. He actually, Simon Sinek, right?
Yeah, of course.
He did I think it was his first really famous talk. I think what it was. He did a... He talked about the difference between the Wright brothers and Pierpont Langley and the motivation behind them, and how him quitting right after they were done with the plane is why it failed. And he said the Wright brothers only succeeded because they had the determination and the why. It was when the whole why thing started.
Yeah.
And that Pierpont Langley didn't have the why, and the proof of that was that he quit right after it was done.
Interesting.
It's going to be really awkward if we finish this podcast and I go back and figure out it wasn't Langley. It was actually Curtis the entire time. But I'm pretty sure it was Langley. I'm pretty sure it was Langley.
Yeah.
Okay.
We hope so. That require a lot of cutting.
Oh, yeah. But moving on to the next plane, so Wright Flyer was in 1903. The Junkers J-1 is the only non-American plane in this list, so I guess I'm either really biased or America kicks ass.
Okay, I'm going to need a lot of information on this one because I've never heard of this plane.
But really, unfortunately, not really too much about this. This one was one that it didn't make the list because it didn't anything super cool. It made the list because it had a very important design development, and the J-1, this was in 1918, end of World War I. This is the end of that arms race that was developing that I talked about earlier. But it was the first monowing plane with an internal structure.
Okay, so what do you mean by monowing first?
One wing, mono, one.
Okay.
So everything else was a biplane or a triplane with two wings or three wings, respectively.
I'm looking here at the picture, and I see that the wing still goes through the fuselage. How did they make it one wing without making it like high wing or below the aircraft or anything like that?
For that one, what they would have done is they have a spar in the middle, and the spar would just connect.
Okay.
But monowing doesn't mean that there's... like one continuous piece of wing. It just means there's one totaling across the aircraft. So even though it's two pieces, it's just one wing.
Gotcha.
There are two things. One, it drove the weight up like crazy because every other biplane before this point was made with wood and canvas. Really, every plane was wood and canvas. And then it had to have cables and struts and all this stuff to support those wings. And that added a bunch of drag, which really slowed down the plane, which means the engine power had to increase, which means more weight, which means the plane gets bigger and the cycle just continues. This one was ungodly heavy, but because it only had one wing, there were no cables, there were no struts, any supports on the wing whatsoever. So the drag was significantly decreased, increased in war. And the, I think the plane ended up being 4,700 pounds.
Oh, wow.
For the aircraft. But it's really fun. You can go and read the book Lords of the Sky. It's by Dan Hampton. He was a Viper pilot. And he talked about how back then the pilots would write things about just how much they hated this plane, because you literally had to unload five planes worth of ammo to shoot it down, because it had 1,000 pounds of armor on it. I think that's what it was.
Wow.
And compared to, you know, the bolts are going to shred a piece of canvas and wood, but this is all aluminum. Yeah. Metal, so it's not doing as much damage.
So I'm guessing this was like the first warplane that really had any kind of defense or armor system on it, because how do you
armor,
put
yeah.
Yeah, how do you put that on canvas and wood?
No.
So if this wasn't made of canvas and wood, you said aluminum is the primary material that this was made out of, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But really the big thing is just this is the first plane that had an internal structure to support the wing, and that it was a monowing.
Was there any kind of, like, you know, if there was any kind of new, like, propulsive system or any kind of new engine that had to be developed to get this type of weight off the ground and flying?
It was a slightly more powerful engine because of the weight, but that was really, it was nothing, it was still just a piston engine.
Gotcha.
There was nothing like inherently special about it.
Interesting.
But yeah, there's really no societal impact besides just the Allies didn't like it.
Yeah.
But luckily for them, it was near the end of the war, so it didn't inconvenience them too much. Yeah, that was the Junkers. I hope you found that satisfying.
Yeah, that was very, very satisfying.
All right. Next plane, we're going to hop ahead 9 years to 1927. We got Charles Lindbergh, Spirit of St. Louis. And technologically, there's absolutely nothing new at this point.
Hmm.
Which is kind of funny because, you know, it went across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
You wouldn't find it very, you would think there'd be something in there.
Well, was it still like the type of monowing and internal structured plane that the Junkers was? Or was it, did they kind of go back to their roots to save weight and make it more out of like canvas and wood?
I'm pretty sure the wing and stuff was aluminum, all that stuff. I'm not too sure on the scan.
Okay.
I would imagine it was all aluminum at this point. But they're really the only reason it, they stripped out all the weight they could out of the plane that was already there, just wasn't necessary anymore. I don't know exactly what they stripped out, but they did that. And then they basically filled up the entire thing with fuel.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's how they got across.
Makes sense.
The
Atlantic. That's how you have to get across. Had anyone tried to cross the Atlantic before and failed, or was this just the first attempt and they just wanted to be sure they were successful?
I don't know if this is the first attempt. I think it might have been. I think everybody else is too stupid.
Oh, this makes sense.
I mean, you'd have to put a lot of money. I think he got a butt ton of money. He became world famous for this. And that's really what led to the societal stuff. The Smithsonian said it electrified the world with aviation, because it's almost like, I don't know the name of the building. I'm pretty sure it's in New York City. Do you know the one where it's one of those roads that convenes in a triangle, and then it's a really famous building. You've probably seen a picture of it. And it's like a triangular building.
Yeah, I don't know the name of it, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
I'm pretty sure that one actually had the first elevator in the world. And nobody would ever use the elevator because they were scared of it. But then the guy who built it was like, look, I'll go up and down in it. And he proved its safety. Charles Lindbergh kind of did that for airplanes. When he flew it across the Atlantic, it was like, holy crap, you can fly planes thousands of miles and you're totally fine.
Yeah.
So they started to get people comfortable with the idea of riding airplanes.
Right.
Which then is going to kick off your whole passenger airline Ford Trimotor.
So this kind of opened the door for passenger jets and the type of airline travel we know today.
Mm-hmm. Even though the presentation really kind of stays away mostly from the airline side of things, I just didn't find it interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
This Charles Lindbergh thing is really what helped kick it off.
Well, yeah. Because
it's all a demand, supply and demand thing.
Of course. Plan. And even if there might not be that many consequential airline aircraft in the world, I mean, it's still such a huge part of aviation today that,
oh, yeah,
you know, it's extremely important to talk about, at least like how the door opens for that.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, Spirit of St. Louis, something I definitely feel like that people have heard of. The one question I have here is, like, I can't see any doors or windows on the plane that we have shown in the picture. Do you have any idea why that would be, or if they're just so small that you can't really see them? Or
you just can't see them in the picture.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they're there.
Okay.
They might also be on the other side of the plane. I don't know if this one had two
right
on there or not. They might have taken off the door because all the gearing and stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you just take that off, put some skin on
weight.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's that one. So really right now you have Wright Flyer kicking off aviation in general. Then you have the Spirit of St. Louis thrusting it into popular culture. Everybody's going insane about it.
Yeah.
And then Junkers just kind of was a plane that had a wing. So not super impactful, but I just figured you can't pass up the first wing that kind of defined the rest of the wings for history.
Well, of course, yeah. Even if it's not that societally important, you can't overlook the importance of just like the structure, like modern structure.
As much as I hate structures, very much can't do that.
Yeah.
But next one, well, really the sad thing, the next one's a 262. It's the first budget plane. What really bummed me out about this presentation is when I was trying to find the planes, I thought I could find a bunch of really, really cool ones from World War II, because everybody, like, that's a golden age of aviation. Everybody loves those planes. But the more I looked at it, I was like, well, I'd love to do like the P-51, the Mustang, but that didn't really have anything groundbreaking. It's a cool plane. Yeah. It's awesome. I wouldn't do anything.
And that would be my next question is, you know, why not the P-38 or the P-51? I mean, those are planes that are iconic, but I've noticed that they're not necessarily included in here.
Yeah, the P-38, the only thing that could be cool about that one is that it was the first one to get into air compressibility.
Right.
Which gave it really weird controls that killed people because they didn't understand them. But none of them, they were all a bunch of advancements, and they were significantly better planes than obviously the Spirit of St. Louis, but none of them really did anything revolutionary that was new. It was like, let's take the P-51, for example. It's still a monowing plane, still has a prop engine. It doesn't go supersonic. It didn't have any kind of big popular culture movement. It had some cool design features that made it good for its job, but nothing that every plane after it started to use.
Yeah. Like, so good, but not necessarily revolutionary.
Pretty much, which really bummed me out. I was hoping to spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
I also used to see the pictures of it. But the only one, I guess this one kind of came out of World War II, but it was barely used, the 262. It started development, I believe, in 1941. It didn't fly till 1944. First big thing, it was the first turbojet aircraft.
Okay. Yeah. Can you explain what like a turbojet is and what a turbojet does a little bit?
Yeah, so obviously propellers were the normal propulsion system.
Right.
Jets were the next one. There's 9 types of jets now. There's turbofans, which have air bypass in them. There's scramjets, ramjets. I'm sure there's other jets, but there's those ones. Then there's turbojets. Turbojets were the first one. They're the most inefficient, and it's pretty much just air comes in the nose. There's a couple spinning fans in front of it, and that compresses the air. And when it compresses the air, it heats up, and it gets a lot more dense. And then with the heat, you inject fuel in it, and it'll ignite the fuel from the heat. And then the heat comes out the back, a thing called a turbine, that extracts all the work out of it. So all the heat, so the airflow starts to cool down because the work's coming out of it, heat's coming out of it. That goes and powers the compressor, but the air keeps going back. And now it's picking up velocity again, but it's leaving at a faster velocity than it came in at. So since you have a velocity differential, that's an acceleration. So the engine pushes air backwards, so the plane goes forwards.
Okay.
Basically a big particle accelerator. Horribly inefficient, couldn't do that much, but that's what the big deal about it was. And the coolest thing was talking to a teacher, Dr. Chrysler, believe it or not. Yeah.
Like a great dude.
Yeah. But he was telling me, which he's not like, he had no research when he said this. So full disclaimer, this is just him being he is a complete aviation nerd, and he's a museum tour guide back in Arizona, I believe. So he does know what he's talking about, but when he said this to me, he didn't have any like papers to prove anything. It's just what he knows. He was saying that Hitler originally, when this plane was in development, he wanted it really badly to be a bomber. So they had to do was get across the English Channel and bomb Britain. That was how World War II, that was part of Blitzkrieg. You'd bomb the living hell out of anything.
Okay.
And then you'd rush in with soldiers and tanks, all that kind of stuff. They learned their lesson from World War I about stalemates. So they did, but the engineers who were building it were like, no, it needs to be a fighter. So they did this little battle with Hitler, which obviously you're probably thinking, a battle with Hitler, how do you win that? Don't you usually just get like killed or something like that? I think they kept it secret somehow. But what was interesting about that was Dr. Chrysler believes if they would have made it a bomber, then the Nazis could have at least taken down Britain and claimed Europe for themselves. And then it would have become an Atlantic war between America and them.
So if this plane could have been so consequential as a bomber for Nazi Germany, why didn't it make more of a difference in the war as a fighter? Or why didn't it make more of a difference just when it came into combat at all?
For the P-62, there was a couple things that limited it. One was range. The jet engines being new, they suck fuel up like nobody's business. So they didn't have that long of a range. And in 1944, Germany was already kind of losing ground to the Allies. I'm pretty sure D-Day already happened by the time this... Yeah, because D-Day was in 45?
Yeah, it was June 6th, 45.
It was 44. Could have been. Was it no, because the war ended in April 45.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so yeah, it was in 44. Okay,
well, the war ended in August of 45.
Well, it was Japan.
Right, but okay, yeah.
Well, back to the planes. Sorry. And also the other voice you heard was going to be the second useful idiot, but he decided that apparently Call of Duty is more important. So, he was going to be the chief idiot because we were going to have two idiots, but then Will just came in here.
I got promoted.
He got promoted.
Well, I didn't come in here. This is part of
But anyway, yeah, it was also part of, I mean, look at the German Tiger tank. That was an extremely good tank compared to all the Shermans. We just had so many of them.
Right.
So I think we did shoot down a couple of these. It was very lopsided, but we could just produce so much more of them.
Yeah.
This late in the war, and the American production machine ramped up. The Germans didn't really have the production machine.
Yeah.
So that's really the only big technological thing with this plane is that jet. Societally, though, it launched the jet age. So now every plane after this, all about jets, supersonic. It gets into specific excess power, which is not really a discussion we'll go into here. But after this, you have the 50s, which, at least in America, plane testing just exploded in the 50s. You had all your Century Series fighters, all that kind of stuff.
So did you have any, like, prop-powered fighters after this plane came into production, or was it just kind of all jet straightforward?
What do you mean?
So, you know, obviously on the American side, you had the P-51, you had the P-38 that was still in service and trying to fight against the 262s at the end of the war. But after the 262 came into production, did Americans or Germans, for that matter, even bother with more prop-driven fighters? Or did this kind of introduce, like, the there's no looking back, we're going to fighter jets?
As far as fighters went, there was no looking back. I mean, it's still used. Like, I'm pretty sure the F-4, the Corsair, was still in use in Korea.
Yeah.
They had the Sky Raider. I mean, we still had the C-130.
Right.
As propellers. They still use them, but as far as fighters after that go, it was pretty much, well, we still used props. That was just a placeholder till we got the jets.
And I guess my other question is, how did, like, America, so if this is obviously a German plane, how did America then so quickly after get that technology within a matter of years and was then able to build their own fighter jets?
Pretty much once. The guy's name, but pretty much America did is went and they all the different scientists, and we got all there was. They were split between us and Russia. I know. I think Russia got all the. What did Russia get? One country got all the propulsion people, kind of. One group got all the design people.
Okay.
I'm having trouble thinking which one we got. I want to say it was propulsion. Because a lot of them ended up working for NASA and get us into space, honestly, and help us with that. But the reason I'm confused is because I look at Russia compared to us, and honestly, their planes suck.
Yeah.
It's like we're better at both than them, so I don't know which one they got.
Yeah.
they look, I mean, there was the newest fighter that Russia made, that the one that they claimed could beat the F-22. They said it was so good they didn't have to build it.
I remember hearing about that in the news. That seems
blows my mind.
Yeah, it seems like it makes a lot of sense. I'm sure it is that good that they don't have to build it.
Also, you can look at it. You can see certain design features on it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's the we got really off on a tangent there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did.
That's okay.
But that's, yeah, so pretty much German scientists came over to America, and that kind of kicked off our research development and all that stuff, and we learned a lot of stuff from them. All right, so immediately after the war ended, the X-planes start. So 1947, we start off with the Bell X-1, which usually everybody kind of, they know the plane, they don't always know the name. It's the one that Chuck Yeager flew to break the sound barrier. So it was the first supersonic plane. Had obviously a lot of technological advancements, besides just being the first supersonic plane. It's really everything that led to it. It's funny because, like, what you think of it as being famous for is just a consequence of all the stuff it did that make it so important.
Mm.
So, at its core, obviously, transonic and supersonic research vehicle is what it did, and they learned so many things from it. First one was they learned about compressibility. So, the thing we were talking about with the P-38, basically, as you get faster and faster and faster, the density of the air changes, and it gets more and more dense,
right.
And that causes a lot of effects on the wing, so that to the air, the wing looks at a different shape than it actually is, and that causes different aerodynamic effects and control masking, where now the elevator doesn't have any authority to pitch the nose up and you're into a dive like the P-38 was, and you couldn't get out of it unless you slowed down, which you couldn't do because you couldn't pitch up.
Dive, right?
And then that's what killed so many of them.
Yeah.
The But they did that. The coolest thing I thought about this, though, was the way they designed it. It's the first supersonic plane. They're doing research with it. Now, you would think if you're going to go design a supersonic plane, you would probably go look at other supersonic planes and say, like, oh, well, what did they do? And we'll do that, then modify it to make it a little better and learn something a little more. And you keep doing that sucking process. But they had nothing. I mean, can you name something in the 40s that went supersonic?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, so they had nothing. But they did actually have one thing. So I guess they didn't have nothing. But it's good for suspense. A 50 caliber bullet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was the... So if you look at the shape of this fuselage...
I've never put that together
until now.
It
looks like a bullet. The only... and it wasn't even supersonic data. It was transonic data. But somebody previously had collected 50 caliber bullets being shot out of a gun, and they did transonic research with that. So the only data they had of vehicles at that speed was a bullet, and that's why the plane was like a bullet.
Another really interesting thing that comes to my mind about this slide is just look at the year 1947. Now, in 1945, only 2 years earlier, like we just went over, we didn't even have jets.
Oh, no.
And now we're able to fly supersonic a mere 2 years later. I mean, that's absolutely remarkable. To me.
Yeah. What does it make Chuck Yeager so cool?
Well, yeah. And, you know, who else would, I mean, I guess we would kind of all jump at the opportunity to fly it first supersonic, but it's got to be terrifying.
So what that reminds me of is the show, The Right Stuff.
Yeah.
I was in a friend's room the other day, and for official business, of course, because, you know, COVID quarantines.
Right.
So, and he was watching The Right Stuff and had this quote in there. I thought it was really funny. They were looking for, the whole show is about people trying to find astronauts to do the first space mission with.
Yeah.
And they were, of course, looking at the test pilot community, because those guys are pretty much the best pilots you can find a lot of times. And he said the test pilots have this really unusual habit. They all die. And I imagine it's because they look at things like this and like, oh, I want to do it.
Yeah.
Which, even though we sit here saying, oh, that's super cool, like, you have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's the 40s. They just built it, and there's no CFD to simulate things
I was about to ask, did they even really have all of the understanding and the mathematics to make sure that this was safe or even going to happen?
I mean, what they would have done before that is they would take it up and fly it subsonically. And, you know, and they still had wind tunnels and all that kind of stuff. But they definitely didn't fully understand it, which is why the vehicle is being built. Because, I mean, you have to do it first. Something has to be the first to do it.
Of course.
That was the first one to go supersonic. And then societal impacts of it. It really just began supersonic aircraft. So now, you know, every aircraft after this is going to start to be, oh, can it go over Mach 1?
Right.
Because the faster you can get, the higher you can get, the higher you can get, more advantages you have in dogfights.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
So what kind of what airspeed is Mach 1?
Depends on a couple things. Speed of sound. Well, let's talk about Mach number first. Mach number, below Mach 1, you're subsonic. Above Mach 1, you're supersonic. So that is, Mach is your velocity over the speed of sound wherever you are.
Okay.
And the speed of sound changes depending on what medium you're in. Like, it travels faster in water than it does in air. And then within air itself, I believe it only depends on temperature. Yeah, temperature. So the hotter the air is, the faster the speed of sound. Yeah, the hotter the air, the faster the speed of sound.
That makes sense.
So usually as you get higher and higher up, it gets colder in the atmosphere. So the speed of sound drops. So it's actually easier to get supersonic high up in the atmosphere than lower.
There's
not really like a miles per hour speed. It's a knot speed, and then that still depends on the temperature of the air you're in, because that drives the speed of sound. And Mach is just the ratio of whatever velocity and knots you're going compared to the speed of sound at that time.
So Mach is more or less a ratio of how fast you're going over how fast you need to be in order to break the speed of sound.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Just because it's not like light.
Right. Yeah.
The Mach 1 could be, you could be at Mach 1 20,000 feet up, and if you would come down here and go the exact same velocity in knots,
you would.
It'd be Mach 0.5.
On the X-15 that we probably can't recreate, so sorry about that, but I guess you'll get the abridged.
It's still a cool plane.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Same questions. It's phenomenal, yeah. I don't know if anything got answered, so we might have to go through it again.
Yeah, here's the X-15. hack everything we already talked about.
Gorgeous plane. Absolutely gorgeous. Looks like a rocket ship. It pretty much is a rocket ship.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think it counts as a plane.
It might not.
Whatsoever. Because, I mean, it has wings, it has a tail, it has a cockpit. Like, it looks like a plane, but it doesn't take off. It only has enough fuel to burn for, like, a minute or two. Oh, and then it glides black down. So I don't really know what the definition of an airplane is, which is kind of ironic. Even though we're making this podcast, now that I think about it.
That should be square one, but maybe not.
I think it's more of a rocket. We'll count it as an airplane.
Okay.
Because I want to talk about it.
That's right.
One of the really cool things, I actually didn't mention this last time, so this is a chance to say things I didn't mention. I think it was the X-15, but they really had a lot of trouble fitting, because what you see here, this picture of the X-15 mounted underneath the wing of the B-52, that was a very common thing. They do that for a lot of planes. They still do that for, I think, more missile systems now. Mm-hmm. But that's a very common way of getting things in the air, to just go test them. And a lot of times what happens is you try to get the plane on the ground underneath it, and there's just no room. It doesn't fit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously when you're in the air, there's no limit to how far down that X-15 could go. But when you're on the ground, there's a fixed distance from the ground to the plane. So they actually have a ramp that the B-52 goes onto, and basically is the wheelbase of it. And then they just cut out this massive hole beneath it, and they put the plane on a ramp to go basically below the ground level. And then that's how they fit it underneath the plane. They basically just cut the ground away.
How do they take off then?
Well, they then push. I don't even know, actually.
Because, yeah, you can load the plane that way, but you still have to get the B-52 to take off.
Because I know that's how they do it, but I don't know how they take off now.
Did they just make it the entire length of the runway? I mean, it'd be the easy. Well, I say easiest,
Well, you know, also they have to account for in there is however they move the plane. Like I said, this plane doesn't have wheels on it. Actually, it skids.
Right.
So they're not going to just drag the titanium skids, whatever they were made out of, across the ground. They would have had it on some kind of truck or moving vehicle, and that also adds height to it.
Right.
So maybe after that gets out of there, they can then Or maybe they can mount it so, like, the tail might go. I don't actually know how they do it.
Interesting.
Now I'm very intrigued.
Yeah.
Right. So much as in a time crunch, I'm going to have time to figure that out. So now that we've decided it's not a plane and doesn't make any sense about how they got it up there, we can actually talk about the plane. So first and foremost, the Bell X-1 was a supersonic research vehicle. This one popped up 12 years later, 1959, as a hypersonics research vehicle.
Okay, so if we define supersonic as above Mach 1, what's different about hypersonic?
Hypersonic is above Mach 5, and it's kind of an arbitrary choice. It's not like supersonic where it's, oh, we're now going to fashion the speed of sound. That is our barrier. That's the defined Mach 1. This was just kind of like 5 sounds good. And,
interesting.
And it's the same as compressibility. We mentioned the X1. Compressibility is when you're doing normal aero calculations and the densities change and you don't actually account for that to Mach 0.3 because it's minimal enough that you can neglect it. But at a certain point, you have to start acknowledging it. Hypersonics is kind of the same thing. So the ratio of specific heat, it's another factor that goes into airspeed or speed of sound for air. So I kind of lied to you when I said it was only temperature. Just the other value in there is constant to Mach 5, which nobody really goes past. So you just kind of push that to the side.
Yeah.
But at Mach 5, the ratio of specific heats for air changes, and that's because the air starts losing pieces of it. Like, it starts breaking apart molecularly.
Oh, wow.
Molecularly.
Yeah.
So that's why you can't really assume that anymore, and that's what they kind of start to call hypersonics.
And that's due just to the raw speed of the airflow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Somehow that rips it apart. And I'm not a chemistry major, so I don't understand that. I just know what happens.
Yeah, I'm just the idiot, so I don't even have a chance. But yeah, I'll buy it. I'll hit the I believe button.
So this one just did some insane things. So that's like a rocket, and that's for a reason. You still can't really sustain that kind of flight. It's just an instantaneous type thing.
Right.
So what they did, they drop it off the B-52, and they would then light the engine and just shoot it right up in the sky in some predetermined glide angle that they determined was their best glide angle. And that got them up to about 67 miles into the atmosphere, which the Air Force now considers 63 miles space.
Oh, so a bunch of astronauts that were pilots. Technically,
yeah.
Astronauts, sort of.
And I have no idea who the U.S. considers the first astronaut, so I don't know if they count these guys or not.
That's interesting. That's an interesting point, because this would be...
Today, if you flew above 63 miles in some plane, you would technically be an Air Force astronaut.
Wow.
And probably in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
You'd be an astronaut, which
I can imagine.
What's worth more, the trouble or the free beer for the rest of your life?
I mean, the trouble, you know, that administrative punishment's going to go away, but, you know, that glory is forever. So, you know, I'm not advocating anything, but you make the choice.
Well, that's what I would say.
Yeah, but, me too.
Well, and then it also went Mach 8, well above the 5 wow. hypersonic. So you're an astronaut going Mach 8, and then you landed as a glider. How do you even handle
that? Is...
Now that I think about it, how do you even handle that as a pilot? You have hanging out from the, you're literally underneath the wing of a bomber, just along for the ride. And they drop you. Then you turn into a space shuttle. Then you go into space. Then you come back. You might bounce off the atmosphere, like Neil Armstrong did. And then you come land it with no wheels as a glider in the middle of a desert in California.
Well, you know, we had a discussion.
Because you have to pay California taxes.
Well, I want to be landing in Texas in that case, yeah. But. See, we had a discussion the other day about, you know, what plane would we want to fly if we could fly any plane. And my answer wasn't this, but it should have been. And it will be from now on because this is absolutely incredible. Yeah.
What I was hated about that is that walkway on the second story. It's missing about 5 feet. So
just
assume that one's real.
Plane it's got to be. A plane that's going Mach 8. I mean, that is... That's a speed that you really can't even imagine.
What was super interesting about this, though, was the Bell X one, the book, the X book that I was talking about earlier that I got all this stuff out of for the X planes, at least.
Yeah.
It had about a half-page blurb on each plane, and it told you all the accomplishments in paragraph form. It would explain each one, all that kind of stuff. It couldn't do that for the X-15. It had about 3 pages of accomplishments. They were all bulleted. They didn't even have the space to explain without making the book basically an encyclopedia.
That's insane.
So I boiled it down to one... words I could pronounce. It's like reading the back of a, it's like reading a nutrition label. You have deoxyglucose couch pneumonia as your ingredient.
A lot of chemical stuff.
So this one of the big things was they figured out how to have a reusable fuselage after reentry. So like I said, it kind of, I guess, technically goes into space. It depends on who you ask. Like NASA and the European Space Agency and Air Force, they all consider space a different boundary. But it was, they got up high enough that when it re-entered, they had all those things like you'd see in a space shuttle.
I was about to say, that seems like it's going to come in handy on the space shuttle.
So they figured that out with this one. They figured out supersonic drop tanks. So like before you could drop a tank off a plane and it might not always go down. Because like I told you in our apparently unrecorded conversation, gravity only works 76% of the time. It's a rock climbing thing. That way when you want to do something, you just tell yourself, okay. Well, really the full quotes, gravity works 100% of the time, 76% of the time. So, like, you know, you ever want to go jump, like, okay, there's only a 76% chance I fall. There's a 24% chance of glory in making it. And then 10 feet later, you have to repeat the process. And
Because the odds did not work in your favor.
And then you turn into that guy that nobody wants to climb with because they have to wait on you the entire time. And like, just do it. Just do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you consider 24% good odds, but, you know.
These guys might have, they got in this death machine.
Yeah, honestly.
But the drop tanks, they wouldn't always fall down because they'd have an angle or deflection of the way the plane interacts with the air, and it would bounce back up and hit the plane. So you can go find videos of
the
tank goes down, then it comes back up and smacks a tail off the plane.
Wow.
Which
not a good day.
In engineering terms, again, is bad.
Bad. That is an engineering term.
Yeah. Knock on wood. And then it flew to Mach 8. They also figured out how turbulent heating rates work at hypersonics. They figured out the hypersonic boundary layer on a plane, all this insane stuff that you can ask me about, and I could maybe tell you what it is, but I could not tell you anything past
what it is. I was about to ask what a hypersonic boundary layer is, but that just...
Well, boundary layer is...
Yeah.
Just the
well, it's a good place to
skin.
Start.
Yeah, the skin sticks. The air sticks to the skin, so you actually have, at the very, very close level, there's actually zero velocity over the airfoil. But then as you get farther away from the airfoil, the velocity increases. And that just has to do with friction on the wing and viscosity in the air and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, or always learned, boundary layers are boundary layers. There's turbulent and laminar, which just has to do with how chaotic and random the flow is or how smooth and orderly it is.
Right.
But what hypersonic means, I have not a clue.
Yeah.
Something above what I will ever learn before my doctorate.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
But there were a lot of people that could figure that out that lived in a desert.
Yeah.
In California.
Of course.
So that's some of the technological stuff. So it's really, really freaking cool.
Plan. I mean, we could make an entire podcast just on this.
We could make it World War II and then the X-15 because those two things fit together very well.
Absolutely.
But then societally, this isn't a super direct one. Like, honestly, when it comes to societal impacts, the Spirit of St. Louis and the Wright Flyer, those are going to be the two biggest ones. That's not changed, as I mentioned earlier. This one was more indirect because this functioned mostly as a space shuttle research thing. So this really was kind of part of the beginning of the space race in the Cold War. A lot of that stuff came. So this plane itself didn't have a huge societal impact. Nobody was running around saying, oh my God, the X-15, I want to go fly now. But obviously the space race had quite societal impacts, and this informed the design of that immensely.
Absolutely.
It helped us get there.
And it seems like from what you said, I mean, it's like its impact on like the scientific community is immense.
Yeah.
Three whole pages of just bullets from what it accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. And then also a lot of people that flew this started to become astronauts.
Yeah.
Which makes sense because they kind of already were in a way.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was that one.
That is cool.
All right, I got two more planes left for you.
All right. Yeah. All right, let's do it.
But all right, next one's the F-16. The societal one, I know you can read the bullet in front of you, and we'll talk about it in a second, but that's really the best I'd come up with.
Gotcha.
I thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that for the listeners.
Yeah.
All right, technologically, obviously, you have a jet that can super cruise, kill a lot of bad guys, dogfight. So there's a lot of stuff in there, but it's kind of similar to, like I said, World War II, where, yeah, they were all really cool, but nothing was super revolutionary. This wasn't the first jet fighter. This wasn't the first super maneuverable fighter. This wasn't, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was the first aircraft to be designed aerodynamically unstable.
What is aerodynamically unstable? How is that different from aircraft previously?
So, do you ever work on cars?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you ever tried to fix an automatic transmission?
No.
Why not?
It is kind of black magic.
That's literally the exact phrase I was going to use. So stability is like black magic too. So, but there's all these ways that there's static stability, dynamic stability. Static is just like you want the plane to fly straight and level, right? And you'd like the plane to right it. So if you're pitched up, you'd like the plane to return back to level. Or if you pitch down or you had turbulence, you want the plane to seek the trimmed out flight you're having. This one was unstable in its pitch. So we'll just talk about that one, which is its nose going up and down. Pretty much at certain speeds, if you were to pitch the nose up, it wouldn't return back to normal. It would just keep pitching up and flip you upside down. And then if you're going, you know, Mach 1.5 and you instantly pitch up, your wings now see Mach 1.5 air hitting the broadside of a barn, rips your wings off, you're having a bad time.
So that doesn't sound very fun. Why would you even design an aircraft to be intentionally unstable?
So it's only aircraft isn't unstable, it's just aerodynamically unstable.
Okay.
But the reason they would make it that way is stability has a downside to it. The more stable an aircraft is, it really wants to return to that trimmed position, which means it's really hard to turn because it doesn't want to move away from that position.
Okay.
So it makes it less maneuverable. So now you go have a cargo plane, you can make it super stable because it doesn't need to do a 9G turn to not get killed. The F-16, though, does. So you do it that way, it turns really fast, it pitches up, you basically move it around really easily. But to compensate for that, the U.S. developed this, and the U.S. is really good at control systems. It's called fly-by-wire. So basically, an irreversible control system where basically, we'll translate it to a car. Imagine you have a steering wheel, and then right now that steering wheel is mechanically linked to the wheels, and it turns the wheels.
Right.
That's what we call a reversible system because there's full feedback. You know, the wheels feel something, it's going to immediately transmit to the wheel, the steering wheel, because it's mechanically linked.
But those are extremely difficult to turn, especially if you have like any kind of heavy car. So like, yeah. So I don't know. It's just like when you get like a mechanical wheel. I mean, the first thing I think of is almost all cars today have some sort of like electrical system, right? Like electrical steering or hydraulic steering. And so I guess like that mechanical steering. I mean, is that how planes were before fly-by-wire? I mean, was it completely mechanical?
Mostly, they had some hydraulic boosting occasionally.
Okay.
Yeah, the fly-by-wire, what really was, is the stick is no longer mechanically connected to the control surfaces because you have Mach 1.4 air going over an aileron. You can't produce the force with your hand and a stick to turn or deflect like that.
Okay.
It was all hydraulics, and really it's just a computer sensor to the stick, and that's fly-by-wire.
Oh,
it's an electronic system. You give an input, like a voltage, and then the plane takes that voltage and it translates it into a controlled deflection in one of the ailerons, rudders, or elevators.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a fly-by-wire.
Okay.
And then the nice thing of that, it almost has a cruise control, and I guess not like a cruise control, what is it?
Right.
But autopilot, that's what I'm looking for. Autopilot. And since it's unstable, it's constantly moving to stay stable, and basically the computer neutralizes the instability. So when it wants to turn fast, it just lets the plane do it. It doesn't have to make it do it. The plane just wants to do it. And that's what it means, like, aerodynamically unstable. The airframe itself is unstable, but once you wrap that control law with the fly-by-wire system around it, the plane makes itself stable, so you can fly it that way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, artificial stability, essentially.
Kind of, yeah. That's okay. A good way to think about it. So that was the first thing they could ever do that with, though. And then the societal impact, there wasn't, like, a cool one either. Like, you know, increased popular movements in the world and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it is a plane that many five-year-olds have looked at and said, I want to do that.
Yeah, well,
so that's happened. I guess that's a societal impact. But I'm sure there's lots of planes that little five-year-olds look at and say, I want to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I grew up looking at F-16s on my wall, too. But I probably the generation before us.
They were probably also looking at F-16s on the wall.
I guess that's true. But maybe our... I don't know, like the generation between us and our grandparents were looking at, you know, the F-104s and the 100 series fighters. So I guess that's not really anything revolutionary. Cool, but not necessarily revolutionary.
Yeah. Then is that an impact that I actually had? I just increased foreign arms sales.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. A lot of our allied countries buy these off of us. Israel, Egypt, Morocco. And one of the things that picture showed in the beginning of like, okay, we only had planes made in Germany and America in this presentation. So not a huge global thing. But once you look at where all these planes have had an effect, like the X-15, I researched any country that has a space program, basically. And that highlighted that one. The X-1, any country that has a supersonic aircraft, highlighted that one. The one that added the most to that list is the F-16 because of its arms sales. I just went down the list. There's like 25 countries that have bought this plane from us. Bahrain, Israel, Turkey, Morocco.
Yes.
France doesn't have any. Poland bought some. I think... Yeah, I forgot most of them.
But
Oman bought some from us. I didn't even know they had an Air Force.
We probably shouldn't get too far into the military industrial complex because that's an entirely different one.
And we've already maxed out the world's podcast.
We have. So we have no more podcasts. This is the last one. But you know, even if we have to push a few off in order to have this one, I think it's good enough to where we're good.
Well, I will say, I do think I have a booming business.
28 listens.
Yeah.
I can't believe you could find 28 people to listen to this.
You look at the demographics, and half are from America. That's from like Belarus, Romania, Bulgaria. So I have a real international audience.
Oh, wow. Very much so.
So there's somebody in Bulgaria that said, I need to learn about the Caravel.
Dave Collard. Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I'll drop the link to some of my friends and people back home, and we'll see if we actually
Georgia is basically a foreign country.
It is. It kind of is.
But that's the F-16.
Yeah, awesome.
And foreign arms sales. Now for the very last plane.
Oh,
and we only made it up to 1981. We could have done more. But
yeah, but this one's one of my favorites of
all
time.
Is it really?
Yeah, so this
you might actually know more about it than me.
So in the previous conversation we had, I don't know if you remember, but you know, my new answer to if you could fly any plane in the world, what would it be? It's the X-15. But my answer before was the F-117, just because of how cool it looks.
You think it looks cool?
I think it's the coolest looking plane in the world.
Okay, so for everybody who can't see the picture we're currently looking at, the F-117 pretty much looks like if you gave a five-year-old a bunch of angled blocks and put them to make it into a plane.
That is exactly
that's what it looks like. It looks like a Lego plane before curved pieces existed.
But like the five-year-old is Picasso. So, you know, that's my addition to it, but just wow. It's so, doesn't look like a plane, but it's so cool.
It is awesome. There were, obviously, the reason it looks so weird is this is the first stealth plane.
Yes.
I'm sure you probably know, you probably won't be a very useful idiot, or even an idiot in this case. You might be useful.
let's go into what stealth is for me, because I am a little lacking in that knowledge. I mean, you know, how is that... What is that? How is it helpful, and why is it revolutionary?
Okay, so for the first, it just means it's hiding from the radar.
Gotcha.
Still visible.
Well, that makes sense because I can see the plane.
And then it also.
So thank you for that.
But what it pretty much does is radar is just light that reflects at the point or shoots at the point and then it reflects back to the radar station. So what happens if no light reflects back to the radar station? They don't see a plane.
Yeah.
So what it does is it takes all the light that it receives and then it reflects it away at a different angle. So it'll go somewhere, and if there happens to be a receiver over there, it'll actually pick it up. But it won't go back to the one that it sent it from. And the consequence, the planes tend to focus it all in one direction. So they try to just make it stealthy from the front. So like an F-22, for example, if you were to look at it from the side, you would actually be able to find it on radar really easy. It's only from the front that it's stealthy, because if you're a fighter, you're hopefully pointing at what's your target.
Interesting.
Same thing with this one. You usually have a really big radar cross-section out to the side, or like some kind of angle. But in front of it, if you fly straight at the radar, they won't see you, or it'll look like a softball size. It's really small. And they do that a couple ways. Biggest thing is they have to hide the compressor face. So the jet engine, when I told you the first part was a compressor,
okay,
that's just a big spinning shiny metal object. So if a radar sees that, that's like candy.
Yeah.
And just a huge cross section.
What's the best way to even hide that? Because if you have to have a compressor open to the air, I mean, how do you keep that from being seen?
They curve the inlets. So if, let's say you have one engine on the center of the plane,
yep,
have the inlet come out in front of it, and then it'll curve off to the right, so that there's actually no compressor face showing out to the open.
Oh,
it
okay.
just curves the air in.
Oh, that makes sense. That.
So they hide the compressor faces that way. And then every leading edge on the plane is a parallel angle. And that way, that's how they kind of deflect all of it in the same direction. So if it comes straight at the plane, and then all the angles that it can see are the exact same, then it'll deflect all the light waves in one direction. So unless you're facing that direction, you won't see the plane. Which is out of a whole 360-degree circle, if you focus it on like 5 degrees,
yeah,
you know, your cross-section.
Pretty safe.
Or you have, yeah. And that's really as much stealth as they got at this point. Now we have curved surfaces, but they didn't have the whole supercomputing clusters and all that kind of stuff that they could do simulations on. So that's as advanced as it could get. It also actually did have a ceramic body to it. It had a ceramic wing.
Oh, wow.
I think.
Well, you
can watch one rip off in an air show. There's a YouTube video for it.
What's the advantage to having a ceramic wing?
Oh, just lighter.
Yeah.
People think it has less crack growth, so it can stay in service longer.
Interesting.
But we don't fly. I think there actually is still one flying for like studying purposes, but it's retired operationally, at least officially.
Yeah.
It's kind of
crazy to think that these, you know, this was the first, or, you know, I guess by today's standards, least effective stealth technology.
And it was only 40 years ago.
I know. It looks like something out of the future, out of the 3000s. I mean, it's.
The only thing to think about is you're looking at a supersonic stealth airplane that was only built, let's do some math in public, 78 years after the Wright Flyer. That's all it took.
Just the timeline on that is insane, just how quickly aviation.
It took us over 100 years to get a Tesla. An electric car.
Just
I don't know when the Prius came
just
out.
Just a fast golf car. Really?
Yeah.
It took us that long.
That's just insane to think about. So those are really the technological stuff is the stealth. And then the leading edges was one of the big ones, and the hitting compressor faces. Figuring that out.
Gotcha.
And then societally, it obviously began the stealth age. Not every fighter is. Every fighter made after that was stealth, because the only two made after that have been the F-22 and the F-35.
Yeah.
And then over here, the bomber made after that was the B-2. Now we have the B-21 coming out soon. So everything is stealth.
Yeah,
and this plane kicked it all off.
Well, what about the B-1? Did the B-1 come before? It was in development before, wasn't it?
B-1, I want to say it started in the 70s.
Yeah.
And then it got some kind of delay, and then it got picked up again. And it might have actually come out after this, but the design process definitely started before.
Right.
But the other societal impact was it had a very large role in making Saddam not a U.S. issue.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
Yeah, Saddam didn't see him coming on radar, because, you know, you can't see them in person.
Right.
Yeah, stealth only on radar.
Still can see it in person.
Yes.
Just for everyone listening.
Yeah.
If you Google it, you will not actually come up with a blank picture. You might be able to see
Which
it.
Now that you said that, we should probably go on there and just like post a blank picture.
We just to mess with people.
Yeah.
For all, you know, maybe 17 viewers who are going to be, or
I'm
listeners
aiming
who are
for
going
30
to be hearing
this.
God, shoot for the stars.
Yeah,
you
planes
know?
Are way cooler than
That's true. Yeah.
All right, well, that's every plane I have for you.
Well, that I can't really argue with that list much. I don't really think there's anything I would put in place of anything else, but
I'm glad you validated my list choice.
Yeah,
very
of course. I'm all about validating feelings and and decisions. So,
all right. Well, thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, glad.
Eric, thank you very much for sitting there and playing Call of Duty and not being useful.
You're welcome.
I'm not saying anything about the other word in our title.
That was me. I took the idiot
role
today, but I didn't really have to. I didn't have to fake it too much. So, you know.
Well, hope you guys enjoyed this, whoever's listening, and have a wonderful day, and hopefully don't get COVID. Have fun.
Go Phelps.